Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, we are talking with Anton Krupicka, a professional trail runner for La Sportiva based in Boulder, Colorado, who is preparing for the Ultra Trail Cape Town event series in a few days. One of the things I've always appreciated about Anton is his interest in going beyond the standard discourse of our sport into adjacent and even more philosophical arenas, and that is certainly the case in this episode. If you enjoy this episode, I recommend checking out the first one that we recorded back in March 2022, which was episode 51. With that, let's get started. All right, Anton Krupicka, it's great to have you back on the Single Track Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Finn. Thanks for having me back.
Last time we chatted, it was early March 2022. I think we were speculating on what the rest of your year would look like, and you know, we're getting to the end of it, and if you look back and think about what was memorable and what you enjoyed, what's at the top of that list?
Yeah, 2022 for me didn't go probably the way that I had hoped it would. I was really happy with the way last year went, 2021. And about halfway through this year, I sort of came to the realization that just because... But, you know, you kind of have like peaks and valleys, or like sometimes you have a lot of momentum and other times you're kind of forcing things. And that's the way the second half of 2022 has felt for me. The first half, I would say the things that I was most proud of was, I don't know, stuff I was doing on the bike, actually. It's just kind of the way it worked out. My Achilles wasn't really cooperative for a lot of the year. I was able to run a lot, but it seemed like any time I tried to point to a race, like increasing the long run would make it so that I couldn't actually, you know, accomplish anything. And so as a result, I kind of defaulted to doing a lot on the bike. And in early May, I ended up doing like a 1200 mile tour from my doorstep here in Boulder back to see my dad in Nebraska and then back to Boulder. And I was doing, I think I averaged like 160 miles a day on the bike on that. And wow. It was a lot of fun. Really nice early spring weather, some crazy weather, like not tornadoes, but really severe storms. And then a month after that, I did a race out in Kansas, the Unbound XL 350 mile bike race. And I was happy with the way that went. Those are probably the things I'm proudest of this year. I would add one more thing. On Labor Day weekend, a buddy and me, we did a 5-day bike tour where the whole point of the tour was to link together a bunch of different climbing crags here on the Front Range. And that was something that gave me a lot of kind of inspiration for what I want to be doing next year, and kind of doing a much larger version of that, hopefully going farther afield. But yeah, on the running front, I haven't accomplished anything that I've had kind of had my eyes set on for the year. So, yeah.
I saw earlier this fall, you had a chance to dabble a bit on the East Coast in the North Carolina area, maybe a little bit in New England. Did you get a chance to check out the White Mountains in New Hampshire?
No, I didn't. But yeah, you're right. We were definitely on the East Coast for almost 3 weeks. Haley is from North Carolina, so we spent a good chunk of time in Western North Carolina, and I actually ran an ultra out there, like a 50K. Just a local first year race, super fun. First time I've done any significant running on the trails in that zone. And then we spent a week climbing in the Linville Gorge out there. But then we had to head up to New England for some work assignments that Haley had. And we were on a pretty tight schedule up there. There's a couple of things we had to do, and there's no time to go into the White Mountains, unfortunately, in New Hampshire. But I will say we were sort of spoiled this year with hitting the foliage at just like absolute peak, and had a lot of nice weather, some rainy weather, but a lot of really nice weather. And, it's just a completely different experience of the natural world than what you get kind of west of the Mississippi. It's just so like the leaves are insane, but yeah.
Up in the New Hampshire area, because that's where I'm from, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Does anything like the Presidential Traverse or the Pemmy Loop or the Appalachian Trail in general interest you in scouting out one day?
Yeah, I think so. it's funny. There's just so many things I want to do out west. It's like low on the list for me. Which doesn't mean that it's any less quality. It's just I don't have the familiarity with the tradition and the history there. So I'm not as inspired by it. But that's more my fault, not the region's fault.
Moving closer to Cape Town topics, I was looking at your ultra sign up before this interview, and if I understand this right, Cape Town will be your first time racing internationally since 2015, when you logged a sixth place finish at Trans Gran Canaria, and you had a couple UTMB attempts and finishes before then. I know that historically, a lot of your focus has been on the American ultra scene, but if you reflect back on a lot of that international stuff to date, what's been the story for you? Like in your own mind, like what's the narrative in your head for the experiences you've had?
Falls into like two pots, I guess. One, I feel like I've actually had some significant success over there. 10 years ago, 2012, Killing and I, ran together for almost all of, Caval's L'Event, which is now Ultra Pyrenees. And he ended up beating me by 5 minutes. I got second to him. And that was on like a really hard day where a lot of people got hypothermia. But I tend to thrive in those conditions. And I was really proud of that race. And then 2014, I actually won Lavaredo, which I don't know, that race is a pretty big deal. So I was happy with that. But then I never actually made the start line for Transvolcania, even though I was there twice. 1 year I was injured. The next year I got just deathly ill, like the day or 2 days before the race. So that sucked. Probably the most sick I've ever been in my life. Like it was, yeah, really uncomfortable. That would have been 2012 and 2013. And then 2013 and 2014, I did UTMB. And, you know, 2013 was leading the race through like 80 miles and dropped out with injury. And then 2014 had an injury earlier, like between Lavaredo and UTMB. So didn't come in as quite as fit as I had hoped for UTMB. And so I ended up pushing too hard early and then like kind of like blew up and had to hobble to the finish. So I don't know. It's just ultra racing. It's a smorgasbord. I mean, oh yeah. Then Trans Gran Canaria, that was a total, like I did that race off of skiing. I remember looking this up once. I averaged like 35 miles a week leading up to that race of actual running. I would have been like third that day if I hadn't gone off course, but you know, that shit happens. That one was just like a wash for me. I was just like, cool. But, so what is the story I tell myself? It's just kind of the same as with all the racing I've done. There was a point in time where every time I lined up, I wanted to be winning the race. And most European races I went to, I had that attitude. And, you know, I came close a couple of times. And then other times, not as close.
If you hadn't run into that string of injuries in the mid-2010s, did you see your career tracking towards like full-time investment in the international scene, or were you always going to kind of be interloping between stuff like the White River 50 in Western States and like the UTMBs of the world? Like, how'd you see things tracking out?
I mean, everything was going international really from 2012 on. The international scene was what became, there were just a ton of opportunities. Like all the races were wanting top runners and were like, inviting them. I mean, I got an appearance fee for Caval's L'Event, and that was 10 years ago, you know, so who knows what's going on there now, or at races now. I'm too out of the loop to really know, but, definitely there was a lot of incentive to be racing internationally. And, I think it's an enviable and privileged life experience to get to travel internationally on someone else's dime. And so I was, as interested in taking advantage of that as anybody. But I just kind of, right when that stuff was really taking off, you know, like 2012, 2015, like, yeah, I mean, I was traveling a bunch, but then I got injured, and yeah, didn't race an ultra for 6 or 7 years.
I probably have like 5 sub questions in this next question, so I apologize for being long winded, but at this stage in your career, how motivated are you by competition? Like when you line up for a race, do you want to just crush the people around you? And like, are you doing research ahead of time with like who's on the start line? Like, are you as competitive as you were 10 years ago, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
The short answer is no. Okay. I'm not as ego driven as I was 10 years ago. I still have plenty of ego, but it's just not as important to me. I think I'm more secure in my identity and myself, and don't feel as much of an inclination to need to like tear someone else down to build myself up, which is essentially what that is. Yeah. I'm not saying that people who want to win races and are competitive in their 20s all come in with that kind of negative sort of attitude towards it. Yeah, but I definitely had like a degree of that, you know, 10 years ago. And a lot of that, that's just kind of like youthful hubris and ego and looking for validation. And now for me, the motivation for competition is, it's like, it's such an intense and enriching life experience. It's, and one that I hope to be able to pursue for as long as my body lets me, you know, it has nothing to do with how I fare against the other people in the race, but rather if I'm able to bring the best out of myself, you know, that I'm capable of. And races are really convenient because everything's set up for you to try your hardest, and there's kind of a safety net, and everything is like, it's all about you on that day to like give your best effort. And that's a rare opportunity. And yeah, that's where my motivation comes from now. So, I mean, no, I'm not doing research before a race anymore. I pay more attention now than I did say even 2 years ago, but it's a fraction of, I used to be like pretty obsessive about it, you know, 10 years ago. Mm. So yeah.
In your experience, have you found that you need to be proactive about that mindset change? Or is it like the natural course of life where as you get older, in the same way, like your body changes, the way you interact with the world changes too?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I think everybody's probably a little different how they evolve or progress or grow in their identity and personality through life. But it wasn't something intentional for me. At first, I guess it felt a little bit thrust upon me with injury. The catalyst for me was continuing to compete in other arenas and realizing, and that would be ski mountaineering and cycling, I guess, and realizing that I still really enjoyed competition even when I wasn't at the very, very front of the race. You know, even if I'm just like the back of the front of the pack, I was still getting a lot of satisfaction from those events. And, you know, the last couple of years starting to do running races again, I have found it natural and easy to maintain that same kind of attitude of excitement and gratitude for the opportunity to compete, I guess.
One of the things that I've always found fascinating about you is you've been pretty public about not wanting to be defined just by running. Like you're kind of a Renaissance person. You have interest in other areas. And you've also talked about how when you had those injuries back in the mid 2010s start piling up, that forced you to seek out personal growth. And I've always been curious, do you think you would have still felt the same motivation to branch out in other areas if those injuries hadn't happened? Like, would you have still felt like a need to evolve, or would you have kept staying on the same course and like inertia would have kind of done its work?
Man, you know, I don't know. It's hard to hypothesize like that. There's definitely a part of me that hopes that I would have been willing to, you know, be a beginner again at something else, try new things. Yeah, like grow as a person. But if I hadn't, like most of my, you know, branching out, as you say, into these other activities has all been, the impetus has been injury, you know? Like, I first bought a bike my freshman year of college because I had a tibial stress fracture. So, you know, so I've been biking for 20 years in a, like an intentional and serious way. It's just until the last 7 years, it was kind of haphazard. It was only when I was injured, you know, but then the last 7 years, it's been a constant sort of like as a hedge against getting injured, you know? And same with climbing and skiing. Climbing has been an interest. I've started at the same, my freshman year of college, I started climbing, but again, just the last 10 years or dozen years, has it been a true focus for me that I've put time and energy into. So it's like the injuries like made space for me to be able to develop these other interests too, that were kind of always just right there underneath the surface, I guess. So I don't know. That's a hard question. It's hard to know.
Yeah. One last question I want to ask you before we finally get to Cape Town. I apologize. And this is kind of out of left field, but I have a deep appreciation for ultra running history. And it recently occurred to me that you've always been identified with Boulder, but you lived and trained in Ashland, Oregon for a minute. And so I'm curious, what drew you there? And can you paint a picture of what that scene was like and like why you were there and stuff like that?
Yeah, no, that's perceptive of you. I was only there for, let's see, this would have been fall of 08 to spring of 09. So maybe 5 or 6 months, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, 6 months maybe. What drew me there? Kyle Skaggs, he and I lived together the spring of 2008, and I crewed for him at Hard Rock that summer. The year before, he had crewed and paced me at Leadville, and he was kind of on this mission up in 2008 to run year round and live where there was snow-free vertical, basically. So like that spring we had spent a good chunk of time down in Flagstaff running in the Grand Canyon. And like Scott Jerk was down there at the same time. And we had a number of really fun, like long days in the canyon, all the three of us together. So then that fall, once winter set in again, you know, he spent the summer in the San Juans, obviously. But once winter set in again, he moved to Oregon because his brother was living there, Eric. And Hal owns RVR there. Yeah. And, you know, we're all buddies. And he was like, go work at RVR. And Ashland's basically snow-free and run a bunch of miles. You know, I mean, I don't know how much you know the Kyle Skaggs story. But anyway, so I moved up there too then.
Okay.
From Colorado Springs. And basically, it was just like myself and my girlfriend at the time, we wanted to like check out other places. You know, we'd both gone to college in the Springs, and she actually had family in Oregon. And so I was like, yeah, let's go try Oregon for a few months, you know? So, I ended up working at the store. I was injured almost the entire time I was there.
Really?
So I did some running, but I didn't get like the full Ashland experience, I would say. Like, I am familiar enough with the running around there. Like, I could drop in there right now and like be familiar with the trails and know where to go run. But it was a bummer for sure, because the funny thing was, the minute I moved back to Colorado Springs, which was late March, maybe, I got healthy instantly. And it was one of those things where like, I feel like your environment, your surroundings have such an effect on your overall psyche and your psychology. And that has a huge effect on your body. And like, I was just like ready to run then, because I love it in the Springs and I love the Pikes Peak region and all that. And so, yeah, I don't know. That was a story in Ashland. It was one of those, you know, it was a good scene. Like, you know, we would go over to Eric and Jen's house most nights and like make dinner. And I remember like having a Christmas party with Hal and a beer mile. Like, it was just all kinds of fun stuff, you know? But you're in your 20s and you kind of just, that's all you're focused on, is kind of like having a good time, running a ton, trying to figure out what to do with your life, you know?
And I know that Hal has done a lot to popularize it, but I still feel like to this day, Ashland, Oregon is like the trail running town equivalent of a musical deep cut. Like, there's like Boulder and Flagstaff and Salt Lake get a lot of love, but
yeah,
Ashland has a ton to offer.
No, if you're a true connoisseur, you know of Ashland for sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's a ton. It's a great spot. I don't know. I have fond memories. And there's obviously been since that specific time, you know, Ian Torrance was managing RVR at that time. He was there. But since then, you know, Gelfi and Laney, I'm missing others, but lots of folks have come out of there. I mean, SOU seems to kind of produce, be like a pipeline from being like a good college runner to being a good ultra runner. But yeah.
They have a saying at SOU. This is what Laney told me, that you either die on the track or you live long enough to see yourself become a mountain ultra trail runner, which I thought was always pretty funny.
I think that's most, well, SOU's Division II, I think. But I can appreciate that. Yeah.
Well, we got to get to Cape Town, and I'm curious how it came on your radar, because I got to assume for context that your inbox must be flooded with every race director up and down the coast saying, come to my event. So what made you say yes here?
I mean, flooded it would be an overstatement, but I do get plenty of inquiries for sure. It's just the timing, really. Post-pandemic, I haven't traveled internationally in 3 years, which is insane because I used to do it 2, 3, 4 times a year. And it comes back to kind of the first question you asked me of what are you proud of in your running this year? And I think Stuart contacted me maybe like in September, early September, something like that. And at that point in time, you know, I hadn't done Leadville, even though I'd wanted to. And I didn't feel like I had anything to show for my running this year, even though I felt like I have been able to be fairly consistent, have built some good fitness. That and the opportunity to travel internationally. I was in Cape Town 10 years ago for a different race. And it just seemed like an opportunity that was too good to pass up. And like I said, the timing was, I was skeptical of the timing because this late in the year, it's hard for me to feel on top of my running, as which has been borne out in the last month. But it was just too juicy of an opportunity to pass up.
We're roughly 8 or 9 days out from the event. What event are you doing, by the way? Because I know that it's been up in the air.
Yeah, well, I had originally planned on doing the 100K. I mean, Stuart, I guess that was the other thing that was attractive about it, is he was like, we don't care if you run anything, actually. Like, we just want you to come to the event. And so there was low pressure from the beginning, but I don't know if I'm going to travel halfway around the world. I mean, I wanted to do the 100K. That to me has seems like the marquee event, even though they have a 100-miler this year. And I wanted to like put my fitness to use. But the last month has just not gone the way I'd hoped. A month ago, I was fully all in on the 100K, really excited about it. I'd just done that 50K in North Carolina and felt really good. But then I just kind of went into like my typical fall slump and for a couple of weeks. And so I had to take a week almost completely off to kind of dig out of that. And it's just been tough to like rebuild the momentum since then. Like if I had another 2 weeks, I think I could pull it off. But it's just, I don't know. This is like getting too detail oriented. But in mid-July, I did a 42-mile long run. Because I was like, if I'm going to do Leadville, I need to get a long run in, you know? And it was a jump up. My longest run prior to that in the summer had been 25 miles. And it made my Achilles sore, the 42-miler did. And so that's why I ended up not doing Leadville. It took me 6 weeks to get back to like baseline with my Achilles, you know? And so my takeaway from that was I need to build more gradually. I need to have more intermediate steps to building the long run rather than making whatever that is, like a 30% jump. So my fear is that I could go do the 100K, I could go finish it, but that I would be injured and that I wouldn't be able to be as competitive as I know I'm capable of being if I lined up for the 100K in, you know, 9 days time. I have other goals coming up really early in the new year that I don't want to be compromised for. I'm not willing to go do the 100K and then have to take a month off because my Achilles is all effed up. That's the thinking behind it.
You mentioned that you had been in Cape Town about a decade ago. To what extent do you know the course, the terrain? Have you talked with anybody that's done the race in years past to get beta?
I mean, I know that Table Mountain is there. I've been to the top of Table Mountain a decade ago. I haven't talked to anyone about the race. I just last night I looked on the map for the first time. I don't know. It looks like it'll be 34 miles and 34 miles of running. I don't know. I don't know. I guess I'm just like confident in my ability across the spectrum of terrain. I know what I can run on a flat, fast surface, and I know that there's not going to be any like fifth class climbing in the race. So I got all my bases covered, you know? So I don't know. It's just, I'm not that concerned about it, I guess.
So with the 55K, what do you think is possible, or how do you imagine the day going? Like what kind of mindset are you going to be in at the start line?
A much different mindset than I would have been for the 100K, I guess. Okay. Just because I feel like physically compromised. The 55K, I want to go out and compete as best I can, but I have no expectations. The 100K, if you'd asked me that a month ago, I'd have been like, I want to finish top five. Like, that's like, I know I can on a good day. So that's the goal. But, you know, in any race anymore, it's just about getting the best out of you as yourself that you can. And it's hard to control what anyone else is doing. That's not to say that you're not keen off of each other during a race, other competitors, but usually your best performance is a result of you paying really close attention to how you are feeling and how taking care of yourself and not getting too caught up in what other people are doing. So I don't know, the 55K, it's going to be just to go and experience the event, experience the place.
Yeah.
I don't ever line up and not try my best. So I'll do that for sure. But I don't think
that's pretty cool that, I don't want to say alternate universe, but in a scenario where you're healthy right now, like a top five finish at the 100K would have been a goal. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, well,
it's a competitive field this year.
I mean, I just feel good, or I have been generally feeling good this year. You know, like based off of long runs I've done and kind of various like hill climbs around Boulder. Like, I wouldn't say that I'm like as fit as I've ever been, but I'm like at least as fit as I was last summer for Leadville in terms of, you know, running uphill fitness and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Couple more miscellaneous questions before we close up. The first, I used to be an avid reader of your blog and I noticed that your personal website is empty. What happened?
That's a good question, actually. For off and on for the past year, I've been like asking various kind of like friends who work in tech, like to help me get the website going. And it's just like, it's kind of a, there's a technical glitch going on right now with where like photos won't load and stuff. And it's just like been on the back burner for me. And I've been trying to decide if I actually want to resurrect it or if I just want to like start a Substack or what, you know, a project for the new year for sure. But yeah, that's what's going on there.
It's good to know that you didn't just intentionally burn it all down one night.
Oh, no. And I think you can still like actually go back and read all the blog on it and everything, but it's not, yeah, photos don't pop up or don't show up. And that's like across the website, it seems like. So something with the server. Yeah, I don't know. I need to like dig in and get it fixed because it's sort of embarrassing, but yeah.
Last time we chatted, you gave an awesome recommendation for a podcast. It was that like Songs of the 90s show, which has been, I dug into that after the fact and some great episodes there. So I got to ask this time, any good books, podcasts, articles, music you've consumed recently that you think the audience would also get something out of?
Yeah. Let's see. Let's go with, I'll do a podcast and a book. Maybe a month ago now, reading a book by Jennifer Egan called Candy House or The Candy House. And it's a follow-up to the book that she won, I think, the National Book Award for maybe 10 years ago, called A Visit from the Goon Squad. And it's a lot of same characters, but kind of like giving more backstory on them and talking about themes of, you know, tech in our lives and music and, you know, what every books are, what all literature is about, just like the human condition. But I really enjoyed this I liked it. So yeah, The Candy House from Jennifer Egan, I would recommend. I think it just came out this year, or last year maybe. But then a podcast I listened to recently was, I feel like I talk about these guys way too much, I'm being cliche, but the band Idols, the front man is this guy, Joe Talbot. And this podcast was actually from 2020, so like mid-pandemic, but it was on this music podcast called Talk House. And it was just an interview with him. And it was, I highly recommend it. I don't know. It's art is a funny thing. I think there's always a tendency to not be earnest, to not be sincere. And Joe Talbot really just like goes hard in that direction. And he gets some flack for it. But in an interview format like this, he comes across as extremely thoughtful, charismatic, compassionate, focused, hard worker, that kind of thing. And I find all that to be super inspiring. One of the things we were doing in New England, we were in Exeter, New Hampshire, to visit this artist that Haley was doing kind of a feature profile on. His name is Russ Pope, and he's kind of a sketch artist, but he's his whole career has been in kind of the skate industry. But he also has had like kind of a lifelong relationship with bikes too. And so he's done some collaborations with companies where he'll do some of his art on a bike frame, obviously on like skateboard, skate decks. And he grew up in California, so surfboards and stuff too. But the whole point I'm getting to this is, he's an artist, like through and through. That's his livelihood. Yeah. And I think artists often, it's thought of as this very romantic, right-brained? Yeah. Right-brained, you know, maybe disorganized, kind of like when the muse hits me, I create and, you know, inspired and everything. But Russ, I was inspired by him because he takes a very disciplined, like committed to the grind sort of approach to his art. He has a studio and every day he does like what he calls like his morning workout, and he sits down and he sketches something, you know?
Yeah.
And this is sort of, in this interview, Joe Talbot was talking about the process of finding your artistic language. And how it just comes from like producing shit for a long time. Like you listen to everything, or, you know, you consume everything, and the stuff that you like, you copy basically, like you emulate. And through that process, you figure out what your spin on it is and what you can offer and how it, you know, mixing all these influences together, something new comes out. And that's your voice then. And I just think that is, I appreciate the disciplined, regimented approach to being a creator like that, or being an artist, whatever you want to say, rather than just being like, you know, cause it like gives you something to dig into. It gives you something to be serious at,
yes,
and not just like, oh, like I'm not feeling inspired, so I'm not going to do something. Like, no, like sit down and do something anyways, you know? I don't know. That was a huge ramble. But
no, not at all. No, that was absolutely fascinating. And I guess I got to ask, like, did it make you think what the equivalent of producing shit is in your life to get to the good? Like, and then what your spin is on things?
Yeah. Well, so I guess the way that I recently, a buddy of mine was asking for a different friend, someone I don't know. He's like, oh, like I, you know, like my friend has this son who's like 16, and he's like quite a good mountain biker or something. And he was wondering like how to get an Instagram following. And I was just like, Christ, like this is like, cause I guess my response, like it's not an easy answer. You know, there's no easy response to that. But what it comes down to is that concept of knowing what your genuine self is and being willing to commit to that and not being like, it's not, it can't, I mean, okay, the kid's 16 or whatever, like there's a whole, that's a whole different ball of wax, but you can't, like in that process, you can't be chasing whatever is successful or popular or gains you followers or brings you money. You have to, because that never works. It cheapens the whole, it cheapens the whole point is going through that process of like figuring out who you are, what your voice is, what you have to offer the world, like what your genuine self is. And if you don't, you can't circumvent that. People can detect bullshit, you know? And so when people are just emulating all the time, they're not turned on by it. They're just like, eh, this is,
it's all derivative.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not, maybe not even derivative, but just like, yeah, like this is just cliche. Like this is just what everyone else is doing, you know, or like this person's done that already and they've done it better, you know? Mm. And what am I saying? So I guess in my own life, okay, like anytime, like if I want to get likes on Instagram, I just have to put like post a picture of myself running, you know? But like, I don't, that's just like such a, it's still a huge part of who I am, but it's not what interests me like on a like excitement level day to day anymore. It's different stuff, you know? And so I have just spent my whole life going like following things that really get me excited and not pandering, you know, not just doing what I know or what it seems like people want from me, but instead like what I'm truly interested in. I guess that's how I would apply that to my life. But then on another level, I get inspired on a very nuts and bolts level of, I need to be disciplined about sitting down and writing something every day, because that's an area that really, I feel like I have things to say and I have an aptitude to say them, and
yeah,
and it fulfills me creatively too. So yeah, that's kind of where I sit with that right now.
Last question I want to ask you, again, a little bit out of left field, but I love ending on controversy whenever we can. I think it's interesting.
Okay.
This is the podcast equivalent of me pandering to the audience. We had Jack Kenzel on the podcast back in July. He's at the Bob Grennan FKT, and grateful to you. I think you reposted the pod and you said something to the effect of the kids are all right. And I loved that. And I guess I'm wondering, have you had any concern in the last couple of years that our sport is losing its way, or the current generation, people like myself, are taking it in the wrong direction? Like what maybe precipitated that comment?
I don't think you've taken it in the wrong direction.
I'm just throwing like a straw man out.
Yeah. I think it's always dangerous to generalize, you know, like saying that the entire sport is moving. No, but I would say, it's funny, 'cause Jack and I were supposed to run together yesterday morning. But it snowed like 5 inches. Because we were going to go scramble. But so you can't do that when there's snow on the rock. What precipitated me to say that? I mean, this is, you know, anytime anyone talks shit, it's usually about themselves and not about what they're talking shit about. And so when I am feeling negative about the sport of ultra running, it's probably a projection of some kind of inadequacy that I have, you know, like maybe I'm injured or like my running hasn't been going well, you know what I mean? Jack, again, I haven't even met him. We've messaged a few times. But he's the one person in the sport right now that I see who, he's not the one person, but he's like the easiest person to look at that kind of like sticks out for me, who isn't pandering at all, you know? He's not trying to play some game of getting followers, getting sponsored. It seems like he's being true to himself. I think he recognizes that he's able to do that because, you know, he has certain advantages in life, but, a lot of people are afraid to be themselves, or maybe they don't know who they are, or, it feels too vulnerable, or they're not willing to share enough of themselves to like, you know, to have other people be interested in what they're doing, you know? And Jack isn't one of those people, doesn't seem like. So I guess that's where that comment came from.
Maybe a weird follow-up question, but has it been easy for you over your career to be yourself?
I don't know. That's a good question. I just don't feel like I've had any other choice. Like life is too short to be pretending, you know, to like, to be somebody other than yourself. It's like, what are you doing? Like what's the point then? You know? I guess that's the way I would answer that. It's, I don't know if it's easy or hard. I guess it's probably always hard to, it's always easier to just follow whatever's being modeled for you, I suppose.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, but then you have to live with yourself, you know? And that's, ugh, that's harder, I think.
Well, Anton, always such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Hope to do it again soon. Looking forward to watching your race unfold at Cape Town here in a couple of days. And yeah, thanks for just existing in the sport and making it more exciting and meaningful.
Cool. Thanks, Finn. Yeah, appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening. Before we sign off, if you are a fan of the show, please consider supporting us with a rating and review in your podcast player, a donation on Patreon, or the use of our sponsored discount codes in the show notes. Thanks again. We really appreciate your support. Really appreciate you listening. Until next time, I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and you have been listening to the Single Track Podcast.